Hello and welcome to another episode of the Daily Remedy Podcast. Today we're here with Mr. Jacob James Rich, a researcher at Cleveland Clinic Center for Value-Based Care Research and a PhD student, soon to be a doctor, at the Case Western Reserve University School of Medicine. And if that wasn't enough, he's also a policy analyst at the Reason Foundation. And with that, I'd like to welcome Jacob.
Thanks for having me.
No, certainly, it's our pleasure. You have written an op-ed and have published an interesting academic article at the Yale Review. And before we jump into that, I think it's important to learn a little bit more about your background, as that'll inform the audience about how you arrived at the conclusions that you did. And I think that's very important to know.
Yeah. So I began my college career at Eastern Michigan University. I became interested in mathematics and economics. And originally, I was thinking about going into financial mathematics and just looking at stocks and those basic financial relationships. But while I was in graduate school, also pursuing a master's in mathematics and economics, I stumbled upon some suicide statistics that I found very interesting. And the reason I thought they were interesting is because there seemed to be a one-to-one relationship between population density and a suicide rate, but it was a negative relationship. So the states that had the least density, like Wyoming and Alaska, they had the highest suicide rates. And Washington, D.C., New Jersey, New York, where most people live in New York City, they had the lowest suicide rates. So instead of doing my thesis on financial economics like I expected, I ended up doing it on healthcare economics. And I wasn't exactly sure where I was going to go from there, but then I ran into Jeffrey Miron, who is the director of undergraduate and graduate studies at Harvard University. And he looked at my research and saw that we were using the exact same types of methods to evaluate data. So he asked me if I would look at some opioid data for him. He gave me the DEA ARCOS data, or he told me where they were. And then he told me to compare those to the CDC mortality data. And what I reported is that if you break these data up at the state level, there seems to be a negative relationship, meaning that less opioid prescribing, more deaths. And it wasn't really a relationship that I expected to find, but that was 2018. I wrote a piece for Reason in 2018 about how the Trump administration's opioid interventions were only going to increase opioid overdoses, and unfortunately, I was correct. They doubled down on their reductions in opioid prescribing, and opioid overdoses have just about doubled since then. So that's basically where we are today.
Thank you for sharing that. I think your conclusion is one that at the time appeared controversial, but now is starting to become more mainstream and in many ways leading to a new paradigm about how we think of opioid policies. Let's now focus less on that outcome of your research and more on the methodology of it, because I think that's very important for people to understand. I would describe you as analytical and contrarian in the way you look at data and your approach to data sets. Talk a little bit about your approach to analyzing data and why that's unique relative to how most have derived conclusions from the data.
Well, I think what really separates me in terms of data analysis is that I start at the data. I think most people try to read the literature first. And even though that can be incredibly helpful, if you're brand new to a subject, it might actually put blinders on. So all of the opioids research leading up to about 2018, 2016, it was pretty gung-ho about how reductions in prescribing lead to reductions in death. But one thing that I really realized is lacking from the medical literature is just very good descriptive statistics. You'll go through all these papers and you'll see these incredibly advanced methods that have all of these control variables. But for some reason, no one wants to report just a basic average, like just the basic average relationship. So the way that I look at data is I just look at it incredibly simply at first. I'll just try to say, on average, do two things move together? And if you put opioid prescribing next to opioid deaths, on average, there's a negative relationship. So that's where I start. That doesn't mean that there's a causal negative relationship between them, but that's like the first line of that. That should be your first approach, the first thing you do when you're trying to evaluate something. And then what I tend to do is I add control variables that if the relationship between them was causal, these control variables would not really interfere with the average relationship. So I'll control for time, then I'll control for the geographical level. So in this case, states, so I control for time, I control for states, then I'll control for state time, which is basically the individual things happening in those states over the time period. Then I control for all of those things. Then I control for various economic variables like income, education, health insurance status. And if the relationship I observed as an average persists given all the combinations of all those control variables, then I'm reasonably certain that we have some sort of predictive relationship happening between the variables. And I always do that before I read the literature. I want to kind of analyze the data without any sort of preconceived bias, form my own opinion from the data, and then I'll let the literature inform where I go from there.
Thank you for sharing that. That was a very clear and informative understanding on how you approach the data itself. Before we jump into the op-ed and the study, I want to go through a few of the terms that you described, because I think that'll make for a more clear discussion. What is, and again, just a brief questions, what is descriptive statistics?
Descriptive statistics are basically just what is the average for the entire group, and then maybe the average for the treated group. So if I'm looking at a policy intervention, maybe a state is pursuing prescription drug monitoring programs. I want to know what the death rate for states before they implemented a prescription drug monitoring program versus after they implemented a prescription drug monitoring program. And then I want to look at the average for all of the states together. And then maybe I want to look at the average death rate for each geographical region. You know what I mean? It's just, it's basically just reporting averages or survey number counts for various subsets of the population, just so you have a general idea of what the data you are looking at actually comprise of. Like, how big is the sample size? How big are the differences between the groups? It's just a very basic, it's like the most basic way of describing the data. And there's really no sort of like causal argument you should grab from the descriptive statistics, but it basically just describes what you're about to analyze, if that makes any sort of sense.
No, it does. And the reason why I asked that is I want to now jump into what you had described between correlation and causal. You first look at the data from a correlative standpoint, and then you add controls. Give an example and really break it down as simply as possible so that people can understand what these controls do to take a correlation and try to as effectively demonstrate a cause or, as you described, a reasonable predictive basis.
Sure. And I'll try to do it with an example from the opioid literature. So maybe, yeah, so hopefully it'll make a little bit of sense. But there are various things that can affect the outcome of opioid overdose deaths that actually work together or are kind of like the same type of thing. So I was talking about prescription drug monitoring programs and whether a state chooses to put forward and implement a prescription drug monitoring program, whether they decide to go forward with a PDMP for short. But what the PDMPs do is that they actually affect the prescribing rate. So if a PDMP has effect on death, and I have both the PDMP and the prescribing rate on the right-hand side of the equation because I'm controlling for one, basically the entire effect of the PDMP should be absorbed by prescribing. As in, if I have PDM, if I'm only looking at the PDMP and the outcome of death, then there's a significant relationship. But once I include prescribing as an additional relationship next to the PDMP, because those two variables affect each other, because PDMPs reduce prescribing, the effect of the PDMP is going to be reduced once I control. And you can extend this idea to a whole bunch of things. So maybe you think people who have lower levels of education are more susceptible to opioid-related outcomes. Well, if I control for education, that should further reduce the effect of the PDMP or the prescribing rate. So you're kind of just spreading out the cause and the average relationship among all the various factors that might end up affecting the variable.
Thank you. And I appreciate you explaining that, because I think those points are really critical in understanding just the depth by which you then discuss key components that summarize your paper in the Yale Review. So let's dive into the meat of things. So let's start with the op-ed and make sure I get this right. The fight to criminalize opioid prescribing. It was a synopsis of sorts to the article published in Yale Law and Policy Review, and the title is, and everything will be in the link below so you guys can get access to this, The Misinformed and Misguided Prescription Abuse Prevention Act, a response to Delfino being a colleague of yours. Let's start with the op-ed and then dive into the details so we can start maybe more high level and then really get into granular details. In the op-ed, you summarize some of the findings and you summarize a lot of the misguided policies. And one quotation really sticks out, and I think in my mind it's very important, but love to kind of get your synopsis on this as well. And I quote, "Under the CSA and regulations pursuant to it, it is illegal for a physician to knowingly or intentionally prescribe a controlled substance unless the prescription is for a legitimate medical purpose in the usual course of his professional practice. Like the CSA, PAPA offers an intent or knowledge mens rea, a criminal intent standard, but also allows for a presumption of knowledge to be established by a doctor's expert knowledge, practice experience, and specialized medical training." Why is that wording so important? One, and how does the data and the analysis of it inform the importance of that wording?
The reason why that wording is important is because the fact that a doctor is an expert, in according to this wording, would mean that if the patient does something wrong, the doctor is liable for the patient doing something wrong. If a patient overdoses, the fact that the patient overdosed in the first place is enough evidence to convict the doctor of second-degree murder. So basically what this turns into is prosecutors have the arbitrary authority to get automatic convictions going after doctors who they think are overprescribing. But assume that someone has like no experience with opioids, nothing on their chart indicates that they would be addicted to the opioids they are prescribed. A doctor maybe they have a tooth surgery, they have their molars removed, and then they are given opioids. If that person takes maybe like 3 or 4 times the suggested amount of opioids and ends up overdosing, under PAPA, the law that Delfino is trying to put forward, the doctor is actually liable for that mistake, if that makes any sort of sense. Like, the doctor should have seen all of the possible situations such that their patient could have been harmed. And even though it's completely reasonable to prescribe opioids in this situation, a prosecutor basically just needs to point at very low levels of evidence to show that the doctor should have known better, even if this was something that typically happens. Even if the action that the doctor pursued is typical, the doctor's expert knowledge should have prevented the patient from being in a vulnerable situation in the first place. I hope that's somewhat of a concise way to put it. I hope that was understandable. Yeah. So please let me know if I need to clarify anything from that.
I understood what you had mentioned because I had read the article and I also had read the underlying paper itself. But I think what would be helpful is if you talk a little bit about the concept of a liability from the standpoint of an action taken and liability from the standpoint of an action not taken, and what that means when you talk about a physician as an expert, and then how that expertise increases liability as proposed by Delfino.
Sure. I'm just trying to think of a concise way to put this. Basically, liability is the concept of, if you do something, how responsible are you depending on your action? So under the Controlled Substances Act, as it stands right now, if a doctor gives a prescription and it is a reasonable prescription that is typically given in such a circumstance, you really can't convict a doctor of murder. It's not the doctor's job to understand that a specific circumstance would put the patient at additional risk given what the expected type of care is. Versus Delfino, what Delfino wants to change is that even if a practice is typical, a doctor can still be held liable. I think that's probably the best way to put it.
Yeah.
Under the CSA, something that's typically done really can't be held against you, versus under Delfino, something that's typically done can be held against you. I think that's probably the most efficient and concise way of putting it.
Yeah, I would agree. So thank you for that explanation. Let's delve now a little bit into the study itself, because I think key concepts that were in the policy review article that may not have been given as much depth in the op-ed were the concept of uncertainty and good quality clinical data. And I think you highlight that quite eloquently in the underlying paper. Before we jump into that in more detail, just talk at a higher level why good quality data matters and why uncertainty in healthcare matters. Good quality data and uncertainty.
Sure. And these are very different concepts. But one thing we should probably understand is that good quality data do exist. We've just been ignoring the data. So what I produced in the study that's novel, what's new, is basically looking at what proportion of people who were using opioids non-medically were using OxyContin in the first place. We see a lot of rhetoric in documentaries and political speeches all about the evils of OxyContin and how it created a zombie army of people who were addicted to opioids, and that's what led to the opioid crisis. If you look at, I forget which documentary it is, but it's an HBO documentary. And in the first episode, they say that OxyContin led to 2.5 million additional non-medical pain reliever users. Basically, that in 2001, the number of non-medical pain reliever users actually doubled. And I looked into it. And what I realized was that between the years of 1998 and 2002, the National Survey on Drug Use and Health, which was previously known as the National Survey on Drug Abuse, that they were actually going through major survey changes. So what you see leading up to 2000, or what you see from like 1990 to 1998, is a flat line of addiction. Then you see a giant jump up to 2002, and then it's flat again. And I kind of posed the question in the article, well, was this big jump because of prescribing, or was this big jump because of survey methodological changes? And in order to answer that question, I look at the proportion of those users who had ever used OxyContin in their life. And what I basically report is that if you look at every single person in 2001 that reported that they had ever used OxyContin in their life, not even in that year, but just in their life, it was only 9% of the population.
Yeah.
So how on earth can you blame OxyContin for causing an increase in addiction in the late 90s if it was a super minority of people who were non-medically using opioids? So first, basically what I'm doing is I'm questioning people who analyze those data changes during the methodological change period. I'm analyzing whether it makes sense to look at the changes during that period, which it really doesn't. And even if you were, I guess this is like the ultimate point. Assume that the methodological changes happened while there was an increase. Well, then you'd be blaming Cody. You wouldn't be blaming pain relievers, because over 70% of the people who non-medically used opioids in 2001 and in the years prior and before, they were mostly using codeine. So at the end of the day, the data really don't support that OxyContin caused the opioid crisis, is basically what I'm showing. But for some reason, there's just not a lot of literature just trying to investigate these data. These data are public. They've existed for decades. They're easily accessible, but no one really has tried to figure out what proportion of non-medical pain reliever users were using OxyContin in the first place. And it's sad, because not only is a company unjustly getting punished, and I'm not saying they're innocent of everything, there are certainly specific circumstances of marketing that are provided by the prosecution that are correct. But the overall idea that Purdue Pharma caused the opioid crisis, that's incorrect. And the implications on access to pain medication because they were liquidated are huge. Like, no one wants to be associated with distributing pain medication, because regardless of what the data say, regardless of your evidence, of the evidence that supports you, regardless of what the data are saying, you are going to be found guilty, because that's what happened to Purdue. You know what I mean? That's the worst part about it, is that even if you're doing the right thing, because this is such a politically charged issue, the way the courts are going to rule is not in your favor. There's really no level of evidence that can save you. So we're trying to provide basic better data on these things. I tried to provide like what the defense in these situations would want to use to defend themselves. But even though I think it's quite compelling, I don't think it matters. This is an emotionally, the juries are going to be very emotional when they make these decisions. They're not going to be very analytical. And
yeah.
I kind of just ask the attorneys general and all these larger conglomerates of prosecutors to really think about the implications of what they're doing and to really do the research before they go forward. Yeah, you had a second question, but I forgot it.
It was about uncertainty, but let's table that for a second, because okay. I think you brought up some really good points, and I want to expand on that, and then we'll circle back, because there's quite a few points made in the study. To expand on what you said and contextualize it in a quotation, I want to read the following. A review by Kolodny et al. Describes a rise in non-medical opioid use following the introduction of OxyContin, with over 2.5 million people initiating first use of opioids in 2001. However, much of this reported rise was likely due to major changes in survey methodology, and any real change would have been almost entirely driven by codeine, which 71.9% of past year non-medical prescription opioid users reported using during their lifetimes in 2001. It kind of encapsulates what you had just said, but to build on it, I want to ask, as I did earlier, a few simple questions so that the audience can really understand this point by point. So the first question would be, what do you mean by changes in survey methodology? I know you literally just explained that, but if you can perhaps maybe simplify it a little bit more and provide a very easy example for people to understand, I think that notion will become much more clear.
So changes in survey methodology can mean a lot of things, but I think the two major changes to focus on would be changes in a question and then changes in how you answer a question. So before these methodological changes took place, the National Survey on Drug Abuse, it was more of a pen and paper questionnaire. And they would hand it out, someone would write out their answers, and then they would probably manually be entered into a computer. So there's error associated with that. The way that you address a written test is going to be different than how you address a verbal test. And then from 1998 to 2002, they started implementing a computer-assisted test where people were putting their answers into a computer. And it was an orally in-person test as well during that time, and they were slowly implementing these changes. So just from the collection procedures changing, you are going to get different estimates. But what they also were changing during this period was how they were asking questions. You can go through the methodology section for every single year to see what the exact wording is. But if something is like worded slightly different, people are going to answer it different. So maybe you say, hey, have you ever used OxyContin in 1998? And then in 1999, the next year, you ask, have you ever used oxycodone? Okay, you used oxycodone. Was your oxycodone OxyContin? You know what I mean? Like, there's various ways that people might not remember properly, and the way that you address a question could help them remember, because maybe you want to make a distinction between Purdue Pharma's specific formulation of oxycodone, which is OxyContin, and then just oxycodone in general, right? So the way that you ask the question to make those clarifications can have major influences. Also, what was changing during this period was just whether you've non-medically used opioids. So if you ask about non-medical use that was sort of related to your use, so maybe the doctor said take 2 pills an hour, but you were in extra pain, so you took 3. Maybe earlier in the survey methodology, that would be marked as non-medical use versus maybe later years, they would consider that medical use if it was during the time that you actually had the prescription. So those little changes were happening between those years, and they weren't standardized until 2002 because they were basically testing out a whole bunch of different approaches. And that's why all of the data and estimates between 1998 and 2002 shift. And the fact that these data were stable up to 1998 and then after 2002 makes me very suspicious that there was ever a general increase in non-medical opioid use, because between 2002 and 2012, we did have increases in opioid prescribing, but generally stable non-medical use. So what would make the years between 1998 and 2002 special, if that makes any sort of sense? There's really no explanation for why you would see an increase that year other than the methodological changes. And the NSDUH actually specifically says not to compare the data to previous years. That's actually explicitly said in the NSDUH. And I note that in the footnotes when I'm talking about this. So the way that Kolodny even presented the data was against what the survey developers even said to do with the data. It was completely inappropriate.
That's incredibly impressive and incredibly powerful, and I hope the magnitude of that is not lost upon the audience listening and watching to this. A couple more points, and again, I hope you appreciate the kind of systematic way by which I'm approaching this, because I think it makes for a more impactful understanding. Now, we have inconsistent methods by which we aggregate the data that leads to inconsistent results. It produces forms of error. I call those errors uncertainty. In some cases, you highlight a little bit about the uncertainty in the interpretations of the data. Talk a little bit about the magnifying impact of minor data collection methods over time and how that can then lead to larger errors, a greater variability in the interpretation of the data. Because I think many people may say, well, if it was a slight modification, then maybe only a slight modification in the results, meaning a slight modification in how the data was collected, a slight modification in the result in the data. But that's not the case. There's a magnifying element. I call that uncertainty. You kind of discuss a little bit about the sources of error. Talk a little bit about the magnification process.
Yeah. So what is magnifying is that the majority of people who non-medically use opioids do it in a way that is hard to identify and is very similar to medical use, if that makes any sort of sense. So if someone has an opioid addiction, it's going to be relatively easy to identify them and put them in the survey. But you have about, I mean, at the height of opioid prescribing, 90 million people a year were being prescribed opioids. And you had about, I mean, you had only about 0.5 to 0.7% of people during that time who were compatible with opioid use disorder. And then depending on how you define the data, you had probably around 4% who were using opioids non-medically during that time. So if you're dealing with a non-medical population that's like around 3 to 4 million, but there's 90 million people who are exposed to opioids, a slight change in survey methodology is going to pull from 90 million people. And a small percentage of 90 million people relative to 4 million people is going to look relatively huge.
Yeah.
So if non-medical use in the earlier period is more consistent with addiction, and it basically was trying to identify if people were recreationally using opioids, that's going to look a lot different than in the later years when the question was just trying to figure out whether people use opioids not exactly as their doctor instructed them to. So if you have like a very painful surgery and you take two opioids, and maybe you're larger, maybe you're someone who's 300 pounds, and the amount of opioids that were prescribed to you makes sense more for someone who's 180 pounds. If you took three opioids instead of two opioids, as your doctor instructed you, then you might be actually marked as a non-medical user in the later years of the survey, versus in the earlier years of the survey, it would have been more consistent with recreationally using opioids at a party, not wanting to go to work because you want to stay home and use opioids. So those adjustments in trying to figure out the level of addiction associated with non-medical use, or maybe better, the level of recreation associated with non-medical use, is what was changed during this period. And when you're looking at a total population of opioid users, it's 90 million, it's going to look huge. It's going to have a magnifying effect. It's very clear that the number of non-medical opioid users who are making slight adjustments in their medical exposure is very different. It's much larger than the population that's actually addicted to opioids or recreationally using opioids, if that makes any sense.
No, it makes perfect sense. And let me just summarize what you had just said, because I think it's important to reiterate these points. Slight changes in the method by which the data was collected, slight changes in the definition of the terms used while collecting data, when extrapolated over an entire population of 90 million, produces vastly different results in the outcomes interpreted.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, To be very specific, assume you have like 3 million people who were identified as non-medical opioid users in 1998. If 1%, if just 1% of the 90 million identified as, or sorry, let me put this a better way. If 1% of the remaining opioid users, which is like 87 million people, if just 1% of them actually identify with the new survey question relative to the old, you're going to have like a 25% increase in 1 year. It only, like a 1% change in the medically using population due to a survey change leads to a 25% increase in the non-medical using population because the populations are so different in size. It's the relative difference in size that makes all the difference. A little change in the big population moving to the small population looks gigantic in relative terms.
Well said. Let me, in the remaining time, shift to something that's a little more aspirational, in that we should always be looking for solutions and ways to improve upon the misunderstanding that's taking place, particularly when it comes to data that has such significant policy implications. If you had to put on your magic hat and either identify a method by which we're analyzing the data or a subset of the data that doesn't exist, where do you see the greatest inflection point of improvement? Is it in the analysis of the data, or is there a certain type of data that we should be collecting that we're not currently?
That's a fantastic question. Well, to be slightly optimistic, you were discussing how what I was saying about 4 to 5 years ago was very controversial and borderline crazy. Well, like the things I was saying 5 years ago are now published in the top medical journals. Like the journals, like journals associated with the American Medical Association, like the JAMA journals, like they're now publishing these unintended consequences of reductions in prescribing. So I think what we really need to try to do is look at geographic level rates of prescribing and compare those to geographical levels of death. Just pull everything away from the big picture national level and just look at what happens when things change at the community level instead. But I'm saying that recognizing that the medical literature is now increasingly doing that. So I kind of want to try to think of something that the medical literature isn't doing. It's a very new thing that the medical literature is doing, and I think they need to do more of it, actually doing like geographical level analyses and then looking at various types of death. It's like, okay, how does prescribing rate affect prescribing deaths from prescription painkillers? Well, deaths from prescription painkillers do go down when you reduce prescribing, but then the fentanyl and heroin deaths go up at a larger rate than the decrease. That's why there's an overall increase in the drug overdose deaths when you look at it at the geographical level. I think what would be really good is if the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration released state identifiers for their individual level data. Because at the moment, I can kind of get a gauge for whether someone had used opioids in the last month or not, but I don't know how much they're using in the last month or not. I can only do that at the national level. And if we had much more granular data on substance use available at the state level, we'd really be able to analyze how these policy changes are affecting use, how they're affecting job outcomes, and all of the other indicators that are included with the substance abuse and mental health services data from the National Survey on Drug Use and Health. What's very unfortunate is that in 2021, the NSDUH changed its methodology, and we're not going to have a time series of data for like a decade now. So the data, the only data that we can use for comparison purposes are from 2002 to 2020. We actually like have a final database of these relationships, and we're going to have to wait for like 10 years before we can finally compare 2021 to 2030, which is something I really, really wish they wouldn't have done, but that's basically where we're at. But since those data are older now and it's considered an older database, SAMHSA should definitely release the state identifiers for the individual level data.
Certainly. And I think that's something we all should take a part in advocating for, because this is information that's pertinent to health policy and it's affecting people's lives. With the remaining time, can you let the audience know how they can get a hold of you, or if they'd like to learn more about your studies, what email or contact information can they use to get a hold of you?
The easiest way to get a hold of me is just on Twitter. My Twitter handle is at Jacob James Rich, exactly as it's spelled, or sounds. It's spelled exactly as it sounds. Last name is R-I-C-H. You can also go to reason.org and see a bunch of my research there. If you just type my name into the search bar, a bunch of the stuff will pop up. And in general, you should be able to, if you have like a very specific inquiry, if you want to email me at jacob.rich@reason.org, that's also a good way to contact me.
Perfect. And with that, Jacob, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.